You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is March 14th, 2024 at 7:36 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And last week, we talked about enlightenment, which is in some sense the end of the path. And I thought that it might be useful to talk about the beginning of the path, the entry into doing that, undertaking this practice. I talk often about the preliminary practices, which I think is the attachment work. But even before the undertaking the preliminary practices, there is the decision to practice, the decision to come into this all together, which I've often described as making the decision to be a good person. What does that mean? To me, it means that you take an ethical stance. And then we talk about the framework of an ethical stance as the precepts. The monastic precepts are in the hundreds, of course, but the lay precepts are five, typically. Undertaking the practice not to kill, undertaking the practice not to steal, undertaking the practice not to engage in sexual conduct that's harmful, not to engage in harsh or false speech, and not to engage in the use of intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. What the hell is heedlessness? Maybe we should say that do not lead to the destruction of your social network. Maybe that's a good way. That is not addictive. But then the consumption of things that can be addictive, it goes beyond substances into processes. So gambling, debting, danger, sex. So what is it to take an ethical stance? It's in why America, where the privilege is amazing and our colonial nature is just bred into the culture, where we take whatever we want, really, and come up with some rationale for it. It is a nuanced and difficult process to open that up, I think. It's not as difficult if you're not in that group, because you already have the experience of less than that main group has. And then, for instance, we're out gay people, if they're white and male, may start in that group, but then as soon as that's revealed, are devalued from it. So there's an awakening there sometimes. The first of the precepts is not to kill. It's an interesting thing. We're a very meat-centric culture, and so the killing of things is just built in everywhere. It's from the first real conscious experience. That's just part of it. It's part of the landscape of it. And we're not talking about a few. We're talking about billions of beings that are slaughtered. I'm using that in the conventional term, not as the sort of pejorative term. But it also expands out from there. David Attenborough, in one of the films that he made about the environment, said that if we want to stabilize the environment that we have, we need to reduce the farmland by two-thirds, and that two-thirds is mainly in the cultivation of animals. And we look at the process of climate change that's happening, which is affecting everybody, Mainly the West, the privileged West, is the energy, the engine of that climate change, which disproportionately affects people that aren't in that position of power. And even there, we're quite a privilege, particularly in North America. When you think about the production of meat, it takes 70 portions of grain to make one portion of meat. So, in a meat-centric society, we already have a reduction of population that comes from that because it's so energy intensive to produce that. Our population hasn't really expanded. So, when you look at North America and Western Europe, our populations are about a third of what Asia population is because of that. And so as the environment gets really bad and we lose the capacity to produce so much grain and all of the other things that we use to support that, let's say we lose half of that capacity in North America and in Europe, we're just going to be able to adjust and eat less meat because we'll still have the resources that produce the meat available if we don't use it for that. And, but in Asia, they're not meat-centric. They're already mainly vegetarian, so they don't have that option. And so as the climate changes, and the band of the equator is no longer really habitable, all of those people are going to have to move somewhere where it's more habitable in order to eat. 20% at least of the population is gonna, of the planet won't be habitable, and that's, 4 billion people. So our little wall that we're building along Texas, it's not going to be good enough. We've abandoned the wall in Texas. It's too bad of a publicity machine. We're building it between Guatemala and Mexico now, which is much, it's shorter and more remote, so it's easier to hide. And the great advantage that North America has is we're surrounded by water. There's no way to walk here, but Europe isn't so lucky. Asia can just walk over. What are they going to do about that? When did you ever feel about the killing of all of these beings, all of these sentient beings? I know it says, in the first precept that not to kill sentient beings, and that in traditional Buddhism, animals are not sentient. That's the sort of way out of that. But our Western science, of course, easily examines these things and finds them to be sentient. Then what are we going to do about the taking what's not freely given? I was very tickled, but also disturbed by Trevor Noah's comment that the thing that white people really like are museums to white people. We sort of take everything from everywhere and put them into a museum, and somehow that makes that all right. And that whole history, say the last 500 or 600 years of the West going around the planet and just taking everything. It's really built into it. And it produces such wealth that we get used to a level of it. Feel in some sense entitled to it. So how are we going to do that piece? Sexual misconduct. Geez, that one's really hard too. It's everywhere you look. We've sexualized selling stuff in a way. We created the internet, and turns out that pornography is the number one thing on the internet. Not particularly surprising. And now with AI, there's going to be no limit to what we can do there. What will that produce? And how does that affect the actual interaction with the real people, which is one of the things that's so puzzling? Will we actually need that? Not to engage in harsh speech. We're just really in an interesting period in our culture where the speech and the harshness of it and the meanness of it is also everywhere. There is no more, in some sense, limit on it. All of the different ways of communicating what's open and what isn't open. And then imbibing in intoxicants. I live in Los Angeles, and one of the things that's apparent about Los Angeles that I know it hasn't yet happened in other places is the invasion of what I call the meth zombies. But it's the fentanyl, methamphetamine, but it's not the old meth that was based on the ephedrine. This is the new method that's made out of agricultural chemicals because we controlled the ephedrine so much. The traffickers moved into other things, and it because it isn't the same exact formulation as that old euphoric drug, they add fentanyl to it so that the euphoric piece is back. And it's cheap. It is so cheap to make that, and it causes, unlike the old meth, the new meth causes permanent cognitive injury from moderate use. Is then this harm to not tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of young people? What are we going to do with hundreds of thousands of cognitively impaired young people for their whole lives? I live in Los Angeles, and it's very apparent if you live somewhere else, particularly places that co get cold, you don't have the roving tent cities that we have, maybe. How can we live in a society that is so rich and have tens of thousands of people living in tents on the street? You see the dilemma of saying to anyone that as we enter into this path of seeking to understand ourselves and seeking to understand the human condition, that you need to take an ethical stance in order to be able to do that. On an individual level, what we're really talking about is freeing the mind so that it isn't caught up in all of these things, so that you then have the capacity to concentrate and then to see how the mind, the body mind, through the sensing experiences, takes in what's around and creates the experience that you have. So we need to care for the body so that we have this vehicle in which to explore. And then we have our role in the community or the society that we live in. I think one of the things about our society, which is so organized around distraction and the normalizing of all of these things, is it's really easy not to pay attention to it. I think that's one of the pieces about practice, of course, which is paying attention. That's what the practice is really about. We're in this push with the general way in which our culture operates. And we really have allowed the accumulation of money at the top, and with that accumulation of money, the acquisition of all of the community-based organizations that would function to provide a point of view that is beyond just the interests of the moneyed class. So we also have a difficulty understanding what's happening based on the information that we're given. Anyway, I'm describing a picture of the world that I experienced that I think is a common shared experience. How then do we take an ethical stance and open into the capacity to practice so that we can see our own conditioning, which of course is affected by this? What is your first reference or your first recognition of being affected by the culture in which we live? The effect, of course, has preceded that early conscious memory of things. We come into a culture that's already functioning, that's already affecting the family that we live with. Our caregivers, of course, have adapted a relationship to the culture which we are also exposed to pretty early. Do you remember a time when you didn't feel that the cultural values that your family system was holding matched yours pretty well? Or did you find that it did match pretty well and you had a sense of ease about it? If I were to think back. In the town I grew up in Evanston, Illinois, the school systems, like they often are in the US, are based on property taxes. And so the rich communities, the schools were better. And with kids in Evanston, Illinois, in the 50s, when I was in grade school, the schools were also segregated by race. I don't know if you had the experience of that. Elementary schools were segregated by race, and intermediate schools and high schools were integrated, and they were intentionally integrated. The idea was that school children would learn how to be in relationship with their community. And then by the time puberty hit and they went into middle school and high school, they would already have formed those bonds. And so there wouldn't be cross-race bonds. It was very thought out as a representation of culture. So in the 50s, that was actually, I think, quite open and more acceptable than it was in the 60s when there was a lot of objection to that. Do you remember whether or not, as a child, the television that you were able to watch was in color or was in black and white? If you're my age, you will remember a time where there was no television because I was born before it happened. And then in the late 50s, we got these little portable TVs that were black and white, and everything was in black and white. Motorolas. We had a Motorola, which was a two-tone Motorola, and it had knobs on it and looked like the cars look, right? So it was sort of a dark green on the bottom and a sort of gray on the top, and it had a gold handle on it, and the knobs were gold, and it looked very nice. And Most of the cartoon programs were on UHF, so you had to tune into it like a radio. It wasn't stations. And it was a wonderful thing. And then in the 60s, they started making color televisions, and the tubes were round. They weren't square. But it didn't matter whether you had a color television because everything was broadcast in black and white. I remember the first show that I saw was the Dean Martin show, and that was in color. And that was a show where they had women walking around in bikinis and the men were in suits and they had cocktails and they were smoking cigarettes. It's the picture how it was supposed to be. And then Garfield Goose, the children's show, was shown in color. And all of these messages come at you. When your kids, of course, you're really looking for your caregivers in order to assign the value of it. And I grew up in a sort of hard right Republican environment. In Chicago at that time, everybody had the newspaper delivered every day. You remember newspapers being delivered? And if it was the Tribune, you were in a conservative family. And if it was the Sun-Times, you were in a liberal family. Nobody really took both papers. And so the stories were quite different. And you knew that as a kid because the Tribune was very staid and very formal, and the pages were big, and the Sun-Times was more of a tabloid, and different size and different kinds of writing. All of the kids that went to those all white elementary schools were primed from the very beginning to go to college. That was the thing. But that wasn't true in middle school or high school. In middle school and high school, you could actually get a job and get married and have kids and have a house and a car on a job that you could get with a high school diploma. So the purpose of practice, of course, is to begin to understand how all of these things that stack up on you before you even have the capacity to understand them create the way that you experience yourself in the world. Is that making sense? So we really are, in some sense, undertaking this practice of pulling all of that apart and seeing how all of those things have affected us, and then undertaking these practices of not harming, really, I think is an easier way to talk about it. Not harming. So, how do you undo the cultural conditioning where you don't even notice the harm, and then pull out of that a behavior and move into a way of being in the world where you aren't harming? How do you object to harm that you see around you without harming in the objection is one of the great puzzles of this. I learned a new way a word today, which I thought was fabulous, which was vegan phobic. Vegaphobic, people who are terrified of vegans because they come at you with such fierceness, you're a blood-soaked planet killer, which is probably not the best way to open a dialogue. Think there was a New Yorker cartoon that is if you don't read history, you're liable to repeat it. And if you do read history, you have to find a way to sit with the people who don't read history repeating it, which is one of the things about waking up. I was talking to somebody about it, and that they found that the deeper their insight got, the more isolated that they felt. How do you then keep this relationship, keep this openness, keep this sense of generosity, of compassion, and then also see all of this stuff happening with? Because what can happen when you can't do that, of course, is that you begin to withdraw from it. The practice is not meant to enable you to withdraw from engagement. It's, in fact, the opposite. It's meant to push you into fully engaging and at the same time keeping your balance so that you don't get knocked into anger or to envy and jealousy and to cruelty to craving, aversion, and consciousness. How do you, when you find that you've been culturally acclimatized to engaging into these behaviors and you begin to withdraw from them, what you notice often is this intense craving for the experiences that they provided, even though you know that they're harming experience, they're harming in some way. There is a sense of delight or pleasure that is associated with the whole history of the experience of using them. What is it that makes you think back to a childhood experience that's pleasant and engaging? Is it food? Is it color? Is it smell? What is it that's actually able to do that? And then how can we reorient the present? Reorient to the present in a way that we are actually actively engaged in a non-harming stance and keep those references, keep that sense of continuity, that sense of warmth about that. I happen to be in a grow up in a family where the fifth precept was just slaughtered. Everybody in my family imbibed in a heedless way, really. I think I'm being unfair to them because it's really my perspective and maybe not theirs. It was very painful. So you come into practice, you make a decision to be a good person. I used to say that that meant you give up revenge as a goal in life. You give up the idea that you need to get powerful enough to exact revenge on the people that have harmed you. You give up on seeking power so that you can't be hurt anymore. It isn't in our culture a common thing to undertake meditation practice at a deep level. We really aren't organized in that way. It's a small minority of people who engage in meditation practice, an even smaller minority that is organized around Buddhist practice. We're largely a Christian culture. So you make the decision. I'm gonna be a good person. I'm gonna give up revenge. I'm gonna give up power. Gonna take an ethical stance. And so then the practice is really about examining what is that stance? What is it, the ethics that you're embracing? So, I would say that in Western Buddhist meditation practice, the first precept, which is to undertake the practice not to kill, is really conservatively engaged as not to harm sentient beings, which means human animals only. I have a dog. I don't know. Does anybody have a dog? I look at my dog's face and I think, oh my God, this being, this delightful being is here. How lovely. I wouldn't kill it and eat it. I grew up in the Midwest, of course, and so in the summers we went to the farms and we'd walk along and there'd be these cows wandering around. They looked when you engaged them beautiful. I see them as beautiful, and really I guess the thing that bothers me the most is they appear to be so beautiful to me. Why would you destroy beauty? And then when I layer on top of it the destruction of the habitability of our planet, it seems extremely frivolous. I have a sometimes I tell a story of a girl sitting on her grandfather's lap with a picture book. Have you ever been around small kids? When my godchild Guthrie was young, I would come in and he would see me and he'd go, "I'll be right back." And then he would rush off. Then he would come back like with as many books as he could carry. And he would sit on my lap with the pile of books next to him, and we would have go through page after page. And I was thinking, "Oh my God, how are we ever going to get through these books?" And his mother Suzanne said, "You know, they don't notice if you skip pages." And so we. The small kids don't have the same sort of through narratives that we have. I don't know if you've ever watched a cartoon aimed at really young kids. There's no narrative, it's just things happening. That sense of aliveness, that sense of beauty. So you take your stance on not killing, and then what is it about taking, stealing, I guess is one way. There seems to be a general sense of stealing as not being a good thing. I was a kid, of course. And growing in the family I did. Money was extremely restricted for children. If you wanted anything, really, you couldn't have it. And so we did all learn to steal as a result of that, I think. I could steal a dollar from my mother in change, so it was hardly noticeable. And then I could go to the grocery store and I could buy a box of Reese's peanut butter cups. They were a nickel, so I could buy 20 of them. Quite a haul. And so that ease around that. And then of course now with the internet and all of the stuff around and the pirating that's just so easy and fluid, at what point do you draw the line on taking stuff that actually probably is not offered freely? Christian.
Sure, this might sound like a question that a thief would ask, but I'm curious if that precept, if you're aware of that precept having some kind of particular like socio-political, historical aspect to it of like what stealing might have meant at that time. Like, I mean, in the guy from Les Miserables steals a loaf of bread or something, and then we're all rooting for him, even though he obviously should go to jail. But so like we can make exceptions for this, right? So I'm kind of curious about the nuances of that one, given how much inequality there is in this world right now.
Right. It's a staggering amount of inequality and largely legal, but then that's because the system is so corrupt. Then what is it? And this is where these on a cultural, societal level begin to just collapse because it's so clearly unfair. At what point did justice become who's in power and not what's fair? Is a question, maybe. But still, in this environment, is in the way that it is, you have the position to define what this is. Right? What is it? Do you have a sense of entitlement so that the copyright doesn't matter? I'll just take what I want. Let's that work. Remember, the goal of this is a mind that then is at peace, so that you can open into understanding the nature of the human condition, that the mind that is agitated or worried or flighty because of it, distracted because of it, prevents that from happening. But it's unquestionably unfair. And it's very hard to avoid that experience of it. So how are you able to hold the experience of that unfairness? And in our culture, the main way of doing that is distraction, which is the opposite of the attention that we're trying to bring to explore these things. So these are the conundrums. This also goes into consent in a way that is, I think, interesting also in our culture. The constant dialogue around what is consent and what isn't consent. And are you confident that you have consent? And once consent is given, are you also sensitive that it can be withdrawn? Or does it simply mean that you are stuck? That you don't have enough power where your consent means anything, or the legal structure doesn't allow consent? You know, when I was in my 20s, which is usually a time of exploration and particularly in relationships and sexuality, homosexuality was illegal in all 50 states. And there was no consent from our community for that. And what that resulted in was a kind of appearance. If you could pass for straight, some people could pass for straight. And so they lived a dual life. But there was no consent anywhere in that, because most of the time the two lives were not connected. And so people in one life did not actually have the experience of the other life. And it's, you know, it's one of those paradoxes of all of this. When AIDS happened, Reagan was in office, and he did not feel that there was a need for a society to respond to our community. He did not feel a need to offer resources to the community. Really had the idea that we were completely separate and that this dual experience of life, I don't know how he couldn't have thought that, but at least publicly he maintained that sense that the communities were separate. 14,000 people had died. Can you imagine 14,000 straight people dying and the president not commenting on it? Can you imagine 50 dying? And yet there we were, 14,000 dead, and still no comment from the White House. So we live in a society where there's different kinds of pressures, culture that create an experience around consent. This is particularly true in the sexual arena, where consent is important, essential, really. And then the power positions have a lot of effect on that. We're kind of running out of time to continue talking about it. This is a deep topic, and there's a lot of nuance to it. And I like to layer it so that it has the range of meaning to it. And I think that this is an essential piece of the practice. And it isn't just at the beginning of practice that we really do need to stand in our understanding of what is ethical, what is just, what is fair. We are extremely moral beings, and this is essential to our capacity for peace, to be able to take on an ethical stance and to stand in it, which also means the expression of it. And then to find a way to be expressive of it in a way that actually is communicative, because that's consent, right? To communicate it in a way that other people can understand what you're talking about so that they can be responsive to that. That's that process of consent. But it's a difficult time for that, I think. Anyway. Do you have a sense of how beautiful this life is, how beautiful all of these beings are everywhere, how beautiful the plants are, how beautiful to be alive and to be engaged in all of this? Do you have a sense at the core of this how exquisitely beautiful this is, how sacred this is? That's the place, that ethical stance, that sense of justice, this fairness takes you. I think that's why it's essential that we come here at the beginning and begin this process, because what you're going to find is that your conditioning has you wrapped up in ways that prevent you from actually being able to see all of that. And what the practice is really about is unwinding that so that you can come into that place and see it. Which would you rather, Vipassana or Metta? Insight or loving kindness? Maybe compassion, we can do some Karuna. So go ahead and take your meditation posture. All right, let go of the meditation. Any comments or questions on that? So we have a new website, which we're just getting up, which is kind of fun. I like it. It's very close to my aesthetic as it is. So take a look at it. Hopefully it's fun. And we have some stuff coming up in April. We're going to do a level one on four Saturday mornings from 9 to 1. Take a look at that. If you're interested in the preliminary practices of the attachment stuff, it's there. We have two retreats up there. We have a 2-week residential retreat in Poland. We have only 5 spaces there. And so there's a waiting list for that in case some of the Some people don't make it. And then there's a 4-day retreat in Utrecht, which is a meditation and attachment level one retreat. So we do the whole thing in 4 days. What else is happening? We're going to do a level two meditation and attachment starting in July. And I'm also going to offer meditation and addiction, both a level one and a level two. We've never done a level two meditation and addiction in an online version before. It's a 12-week course that meets 3 times a week for an hour. So 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. Pacific time, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The format of that is a Monday is a didactic. So the information, Wednesday is meditation instruction, and Friday is a processing of the material. We go through the four modules of the meditation and addiction, craving and urging, stress, anger, and depression, persistent negative emotions, and difficult interpersonal relationships are the main conduits for relapse. So this is really intended for people that have abstinence or harm reduction strategies in place that are then looking to support that. And we use the attachment lens to talk about the underlying conditioning that leads people into addictive paths. So that's what's coming up. Take a look at it. It should be on the website, Christian.
George, I did have a question about the compassion meditation.
Okay.
Do you see like getting into the mind state as like going hand in hand with opening up to like whatever emotions are coming up, or like opening up to feel in space, or kind of like sensitizing oneself to that for self-compassion practice?
In compassion for self, my mind gets hung up on the language. Self-compassion is really a sympathy, but one of the things that happens when we are conditioned is that we begin to limit the information that we allow ourselves to know about ourselves. And so I really think that self-compassion or compassion for self-practice is about opening up and allowing all of the information about the self, allowing yourself to know everything about you. You know, what are your thought processes? What are your desires? What is it that operates, that makes the experience of you good and bad, right? Sometimes we cast value on the quality of those processes, which is largely related to our conditioning. And so it really does produce these insights into the nature of our experience. You might say that shame was one of those experiences, but how is that the experience of shame arising around certain things actually what it is that you feel, or is it actually the response to the conditions of your earlier life that have cast those particular desires or thoughts in that way? You know, if you were to use an attachment reference, dismissing people's suppressed awareness of their emotions as the primary way of regulating themselves. And so with compassion practice, what you would be doing is opening a space where you are allowed to have those experiences of emotion. So everybody's conditioning is different, and the process of filtering or restricting what's knowable about yourself differs quite a bit depending on your experience. And so really what this is this opening to allow all of that information, everything that you can know about yourself, into a conscious experience of it, which is actually very freeing. It doesn't mean, of course, that you have to act on every thought that you have. We probably wouldn't want that. But to know. Because if you don't allow yourself to know, it's still operational because the you-ness, the Christian-ness is unconscious. And all of those decisions are already made in that unconscious process. And if you simply don't allow the information consciously, you can't really understand why you act in the way that you do, why you respond in the way that you do. So that compassion for self practice is to open up and hold the whole thing so that you have the capacity to understand how you've made reality. That's really what we're trying to get at. I just made this up. Why did I make it up like this? And if you don't let yourself in on it, then I just made this up and I can't understand my reaction to this because I don't have, I'm not allowing myself to know what the meaning is. That's what we're trying to do.
Great. I think, I mean, I was having the experience of, I was wondering if I was emotionally regulating by like getting sleepy, because I found myself starting really sleepy, and as the practice went on, that really went away. And I was like, oh, I wonder if by like tuning into some emotion that's maybe difficult or something, instead of going to sleep, which doesn't seem like a conscious process.
That is one of the great defenses.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks.
Yeah. We want to get to that place where we don't have to defend ourselves from ourselves. It'd be nice. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate your practice. I think it's important. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope if you're resourced and you can, that you'll make a donation. There's a link on the website. I'm not actually even sure where it is, but I think there's a donate button there somewhere. The other thing you might consider on the website is my great passion, my great exploration in life is photographs. And so I added that to the site as a discussion of exploration, which I think is an important thing. I don't think you necessarily need to make photographs, but I think that that we really, if we haven't been supported in our primary exploration, we don't do enough of it. And so the idea then is to understand what that the nature of primary exploration is, and then to go do it, because that's the thing that propels us through this human condition. And if we don't do it enough, just the difficulty of it, particularly as you age, becomes greater and greater, and then you have a tendency to withdraw more rather than engage more. Thank you. We'll see you soon, I hope. Bye.